Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. How will the Trump presidency affect reproductive rights for abortion and even contraception? It's not at all clear how issues of access and cost will play out. Trump has said he will nominate pro-life judges to the Supreme Court and that he wants to repeal and replace Obamacare, which fully covers birth control. One social media meme that maybe you've seen or shared is for women to get IUDs now while they're still covered by insurance, IUDs because they last for years. Here with me now to talk about what could happen and answer your questions on reproductive rights in the era of Trump is Elise Hoag, the president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America, the organization dedicated to expanding and protecting reproductive freedom. Elise, welcome back to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, it's great to be here. I wish it was under better circumstances.
Yes. I saw you personally quoted as personally veering between disbelief, fear, denial, and anger. I guess you wrote that in Cosmopolitan. But you also wrote, the fight for our values isn't won or lost in a single election. And a president doesn't make reproductive rights decisions on his own. So what's your biggest fear?
I mean, you know, my biggest fear is that we adjust very quickly to what is considered a new normal. Where, you know, we saw this during the campaign where Donald Trump used shock and awe to sort of take the bar so low in terms of what we believed was offensive or something we should examine coming out of somebody actually running to be our commander in chief. And I think we're going to start to see that move not only into the rhetorical realm, but the policy realm. And so, you know, I have big concerns. I have big concerns about the nominations to the Supreme Court. I have big concerns that when Congress comes back in session on January 6th, that the first thing that they vote on vis-a-vis Obamacare is to remove the contraception mandate, which has made contraception so much more widely available to women all over this country. I have great fear that they will actually ban abortion after 20 weeks as soon as possible. But really, my overarching fear is that we start to see these as small things when they are anything but, because they are happening so regularly and wrapped in such extreme rhetoric that we just adjust to what we call the new normal.
Listeners, we can take a few questions for Elise Hoag, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, 212-433-WNYC. Everybody's wondering, is Donald Trump, the president, going to be different from Donald Trump, the candidate? And he gave an indication of that already on the question of reproductive rights. I'm going to play a 55-second clip of Trump with Leslie Stahl from 60 Minutes on Sunday.
Will you appoint, are you looking to appoint a justice who wants to overturn Roe v. Wade?
So look, here's what's going to happen. I'm pro-life. The judges will be pro-life. They'll be.
But what about overturning this law?
Well, there are a couple of things. They'll be pro-life. They'll be in terms of the whole gun situation. We know the Second Amendment, and everybody's talking about the Second Amendment, and they're trying to dice it up and change it. They're going to be very pro-Second Amendment. But having to do with abortion, what it, if it ever were overturned, it would go back to the states. So
yeah,
it would go back to the states.
Some women
and the states
won't be able to get an abortion.
No, it'll go back to the states.
By state? No, some.
Yeah. Well, they'll perhaps have to go to they'll have to go to another state.
And that's okay.
Well, we'll see what happens. It's got a long way to go, just so you understand. That has a long, long way to go.
I know what you want to react to there, I think. It's so she'll have to go to another state.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that Donald Trump is actually, the way that he's framing this is super interesting, right? Because he actually knows what we know to be true, which is it may be the extreme anti-choice movement that helped get him elected, but the vast majority of people who voted for him actually did not vote for him to make abortion more difficult to access. We live in a majority pro-choice country where even people who say, you know what, I probably would never do that myself, still don't think the government should be making that decision or making it more difficult and thereby more dangerous for women who need to access abortion services. So he's trying to play it both ways. I think that what we need to recognize, and this sort of goes to what you were saying earlier about the role of the president, is Donald Trump just, you know, assumed the presidency at a time where the extreme anti-choice movement is seeing the sort of penultimate achievement of 30 years of work that they've done to take over state legislatures. So if it were to go back to the states, we would immediately see abortion almost impossible to get in many, many states around the country. So what I think we're talking about is a very small number of asylum spaces in the country, and what we all know, which is that women with means will be able to travel to those states, and women without means will find a different way to do what women have always done when they don't want to be pregnant, and they are. And we have to remember that that is already happening around the country. In Texas, where, you know, the clinic access was drying up for years and years, a research study found that 12% of women in the Rio Grande Valley, these are poor women, these are women without access to travel, were attempting to self-abort before they could reach a clinic. We saw this under Mike Pence in Indiana, where a young immigrant woman named Purvi Patel attempted a home abortion and was actually sentenced to 20 years in prison for it. So this is not a theoretical. We actually know what happens when women are not able to access the kind of care that they need. It's not pretty, and it always, always affects poor women, disproportionately women of color, immigrant women, more than it affects the people that Trump is trying to pacify who voted for him.
I realize that there could be several openings on the Supreme Court over the next 4 years, because of how many aged Supreme Court justices there are. But are you reassured about the solidity of Roe based on the decision that the court made this term, that rather than weaken Roe, it used Roe as the basis to throw out the Texas abortion law, where, you know, the particular restrictions on what doctors had to do and what clinics had to do were seen as violating a woman's constitutional basic right to choose under the laws as the Supreme Court had interpreted in the 1970s. So does that give you faith that and I don't remember if Scalia was still alive and on
no,
the court.
Well, Scalia heard the case but was not there. No, Scalia did not hear the case. I'm sorry. God, it feels like so long ago, doesn't it? It was one of the first big cases that happened after he passed away. And then, obviously, was not a part of the decision.
But it wasn't a 4-4 tie, right?
No, it was certainly not. And it is helpful, right? What that victory showed was, I always say, it was victory. I'm a Texan. I'm from Texas. Uh-huh. So it was a victory for Texas. It was victory for women around the country. But it was a victory for evidence-based decision-making. What the court found was that there was no way to justify these clinic regulations under the name of women's health, and the primary purpose of these clinics is women's health, so that they were artificial, imposed on the clinics in an effort to actually shut them down, and could not be justified under the incentive for making the law in the first place. So that's good, right? It is good. We want the court actually looking at evidence and making decisions that way. I think it's anyone's guess what kind of case the anti-choice movement would bring to overturn Roe, but it certainly wouldn't be a similar case to what we called the trap laws in the whole women's health case that we did win, because it would go to the very core constitutionality of the right to terminate a pregnancy. And there are all different legal ways to do that. I'm not a lawyer. I don't even play one on TV. I'm good friends with lawyers who work in the movement. But what I will tell you is that the anti-choice movement has been pretty savvy in bringing cases in the past. So we have to keep a very, very clear eye on it. And while we do appreciate the current court for their evidence-based decision-making, there may not be a lot of parallels between that case and the case that they would bring to overturn Roe.
Lori in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC with Elise Hoag. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking the call. What I wanted to say is that, you know, going along with the idea that this is not theoretical. After a lifetime of research, I discovered that my maternal grandmother died of an illegal abortion. My mother grew up without her mother, without her siblings, because they were dispersed amongst relatives, and it just totally destroyed this working family because a poor woman had no alternative, you know, other than to seek, you know, not good care. And it was all kept secret, and I am just so fearful, and I take this issue so personally, because we cannot go back to that time. Women deserve to have access to health care. That's the bottom line. And I just cannot, I find it difficult living in a country that doesn't understand the importance of that.
Yeah, I mean, Lori brings up so many good points illustrated by her personal family history, and we hear about stories like this all of the time. I mean, I think one of the most important points she brings up is that we live in some sort of academic fantasy world so often in the political debate in this country, where we talk about reproductive freedom as though it's separate from economic security, when the reality is the ability to safely and with dignity determine how and when and with whom you have a family has everything to do with your ability to finish school, to do your job, to keep your job, to take care of the family you have. It's important to remember 6 in 10 women who seek abortion care are already mothers trying to take care of the families that they have, and that when abortion is more difficult to get, it doesn't drive the number of abortions down. It just drives the number of consequences up, which has a resonant effect on these families and the livelihoods. The other point that Lori is making that I think is really important for your listeners to understand is that this is, you know, abortion is a medical procedure. It is one that women will seek regardless of what the laws are. What we really need to be talking about in the political context is why we have a set of people running for office who actually don't trust women, don't have enough respect for women to believe that we should be in command of our own medical decisions, and by proxy, our own lives, right? And I always say this is not really a fight about abortion, because if it was, Mike Pence and Donald Trump would join hands with us and fight for greater access to contraception and fight for the kinds of policies that support, you know, working moms who are already struggling to make ends meet. But they don't do any of that. They fight those things too. And so what it is a fight about women's place in society, whether we believe that we should be equals with dignity, trusted to make our own decisions, or whether in Mike Pence's and Donald Trump's worldview, we're there to be controlled, we're there to be preyed upon sexually, or told what to do when it comes to childbearing. And, you know, I just don't think that the majority of Americans actually believe women can't make our own decisions.
Tara in Harlem, you're on WNYC with Elise Hoag, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Hi, Tara.
Hi. I'm calling because I heard your guest saying that she's horrified that if a pregnancy went beyond 20 weeks, that would end. And I'm pro-choice. I'm not pro-life. I'm horrified by Trump and all that. But I feel like the issue that's never really addressed are the people who kind of live in the gray area, where I believe women should be able to have abortions. But I do have concerns and thoughts and worries about the kind of throwaway comment that of being horrified of a baby being terminated after 20 weeks. And to me, that does give me pause.
Yeah, I really appreciate that comment. I think that there are a lot of people who sort of have mixed feelings, and I actually think that the pro-choice movement is so welcoming of people like Tim Kaine, who in the vice presidential debate said, you know, I have my faith, and my faith gives me pause, but what I do believe is that I'm not the best person to determine this for other people. And, you know, one of the things that we know and that doctors tell us all the time is that so few women seek to terminate pregnancies after 20 weeks, and that almost nobody wakes up and says, oh, no, I forgot, you know, I forgot to do this, that what they are women who have faced really difficult diagnoses after 20 weeks where their life is in danger. There's some pretty significant issues with the fetus, and that those cases are the last place we want politicians who know nothing about those individual women and the individual health consequences that they're facing interfering. Those are absolutely places. And as someone who recently was pregnant and had all sorts of scares along the way, although so gratefully gave birth to healthy children, you know, when I was scared, I didn't want Donald Trump actually in the exam room with me. I wanted my doctor walking me through what are we seeing, what does it mean, what are the best medical decisions in this situation. And in those tiny portion of cases where that happens later in pregnancy, they're really medically complicated, and we absolutely don't want politicians who know nothing about those individual medical cases interfering.
Tara, did she convince you of anything?
Yes, I guess it's just more when I hear about it talked on the radio, you know, on NPR, that I always feel like there's kind of a our way or the highway, and not necessarily people saying that to me directly, but that I just don't hear the middle ground. And I do appreciate it that it's a very small amount, but, you know, I've seen many ultrasounds at five months, and I can't really get on board with it not being a living thing, you know, just by seeing the little baby. So, but like I said, of course, when she says that, no, you don't want starting to tear down the wall and slowly getting to the overall sense of Roe versus Wade. But I do wish that more people would talk about the gray area, because I know a lot of people who do have thoughts about that.
Tara, thank you so much. We really appreciate your call and your thoughts. As we begin to run out of time, how concerned are you that Mike Pence will play an activist role as vice president? We know that he's been one of the most anti-abortion rights governors in the nation, if not the most, and signed that bill that would have done things had a court not stopped it, like prevent abortions for the reason of fetal abnormalities, no matter how extreme, and require funerals for fetuses after abortions in some cases. He might be able to get the Republican Congress to pass things like that, even though I don't think they've gone that far in congressional bills, even with the Republican House and Senate. How concerned are you about that, or do you think that in the new context of vice president, this is just not going to be big on his plate?
No, I actually think Mike Pence is one of those rare politicians who got into politics there, you know, because of his deeply held anti-choice, anti-LGBT, sort of normative family beliefs, and that his track record as governor shows, and as a congressman, shows as much, right? That's where he spends his time. It's where he's focused his energy. He has either attempted to or been successful at passing some of the very most extreme laws in those arenas in both of his capacities. I am really concerned. I mean, this is, you know, during the campaign, news leaked that Trump was actually kind of peddling the vice presidential seat as the most powerful vice president in the history, because he apparently did not have that much interest in running the day-to-day business. So I think Mike Pence, as one of the most anti-women politicians in the country, will have disproportionate impact, not only on the priorities domestically and maybe internationally, although I think Trump has more interest there, of the executive branch, but he is so connected to so many of the GOP congressmen and senators that he'll play a very big role in day-to-day activities. And, you know, I think we'll start to see that as soon as they reconvene.
Elise Hoge, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, thank you for coming on with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue in a minute.